If you're a classical music fan, you may have noticed that it's very difficult to search for particular works of music on most streaming services. You can only search for artist, title of the song, and title of the album. But classical music fans need to search by composer, work, conductor, orchestra, period, and genre. Adagio has solved this problem for classical music fans. The Adagio streaming service has been designed specifically for the classical genre and makes it easy to compare multiple recordings and versions of the same works. So if you search for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, for instance, you would be able to compare more than 150 recordings on one page and then filter them by conductor or orchestra. I especially like Adagio's curated playlists, which have enabled me to discover a lot of classical music I didn't know about before. Now you can try Adagio for free for 14 days and then pay just $9.99 per month when you subscribe. To try it out, visit podcast.idagio.com/renegade. Again, that's podcast.idagio, idagio.com/renegade. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. We've just confirmed two special guests for the Renegade University weekends in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. Dr. Christopher Ryan, the author of Sex at Dawn, will be joining us in Los Angeles on February 2nd. And Camille Foster of Freethink Media and the Fifth Column podcast will be at the Renegade University event in Washington, D.C. from March 15th to the 17th. For more information and to buy tickets to the Renegade University weekend events in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. My guest this week is someone I've learned a lot from over the last few years. She is an expert on relationships. Relationships between people, and relationships between people and places. The first thing you need to know about this conversation is that it's not about love. This is my interview with Kathy Reisenwitz. So I'm sitting in a place that used to make me very sad. No, it used to make me very happy, and then it started to make me very sad, and now I no longer care, which is San Francisco, which is basically my hometown. I grew up across the bay in Berkeley, as a lot of people know. And I used to be the most obnoxious, disgusting, insufferable Bay Area chauvinist. Wherever I would go, I would talk about how it was the only place in the United States to live. I mean, I was that bad. And then, of course, it became unlivable because of people like the person who's sitting across from me. These tech people move into my city with all their money, and they drive us out with, you know, their high spending ways, driving up rents and the like. And so I want to say, Kathy Reisenwitz, I need you to explain yourself. Why did you ruin my city? No, we'll get back to that in a second. No, this is Kathy Reisenwitz, who I've been following for many, many years because I have thought she is really smart, and I thought that she's added a lot to political conversations that I was interested in. In particular, when I became interested in libertarians sort of from the outside, you were emerging pretty much at that moment as like the first or one of the first self-described feminists within the movement, and you were sort of challenging libertarians on those issues, and there was a whole lot of pushback, and I found that fight to be fascinating because I didn't want to be part of a movement in which your kind of feminism was not allowed. And so that's why I was kind of checking in and especially interested in you and what was happening to you. And then you've changed, and I mean, you're still very interested in those issues, but you've moved to San Francisco, and now you're kind of one of the, I think one of the leaders, right, of this so-called YIMBY movement, right? Yes, in my backyard, which a lot of people don't know about, but it's very important to me because you're trying to save my city. You're actually not responsible for destroying it. And I really think it's destroyed. I know you like it, but to me, San Francisco, LA, and New York are basically all unlivable now. Those are the three cities I've lived in my life. Those are the only places I've lived in fact. But we'll get into that. That's a policy question, an economics question. We'll get into that later. I wanted to go back though and talk about that moment, the Kathy Reisenwitz moment when everybody in the libertarian movement was talking about you. And I'd say there was more negative said about you than positive. That was only a credit to you from my point of view, because much of the criticism of you I thought was, I wouldn't even say reactionary. I would say it was cave-like, you know, cave people-like. So you became a libertarian at some point.
I did.
Now, how'd that happen?
I was always super conservative, shockingly.
In Republican Party ways, you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And however, and this is true of my mother as well, I've always had a weird feminist streak that didn't fit in with the Christianity.
I was wondering about your mom and feminism, because it sounds like she might have a little bit of that tendency within her.
Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly. My mom is a badass feminist.
Is she?
Yeah. Huh. Definitely.
Why do you say that?
She's just never believed women don't have a ton to offer the world beyond their reproductive capacity.
In the way that the world is structured. And she
right.
doesn't like that.
No. I mean, she's always experienced and recognized sexism for what it is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm saying that's her critique. It's not her. Because you could say that about the world and welcome it. And you're saying she doesn't like that about the world. That it's,
right. She wants to see women meet their potential.
So did she work?
Yes.
Aha. Okay. There you go. Once you get women working, it's all over. Seriously, right? If you've read my book, you know, like once the Industrial Revolution happens, right, and there's all these jobs for women for the first time that had to be filled by women, it was game over, basically. I mean, that was the beginning of modern feminism. And my view was in the 1880s when these women have money on their own. You'll appreciate this, right? Wages that they were making, property that they owned. They could do whatever they wanted with it. They had places to spend it that were fun, where you could meet boys or girls and have sex with them, et cetera. Capitalism. You know about this? I mean, this whole argument about both for women and gays, it's the best thing that ever happened to both of those groups.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Well, one thing that I think is really interesting is that a lot of cultural reactionaries want to give feminism way more credit than it deserves. Feminism resulted from economic realities.
Totally.
It did not drive any economic realities whatsoever.
You, I love you even more now. I've never heard anyone say that except for me. No, actually, I haven't said that either. That's your own formulation. I've never put that together that way. I love that. That's pretty, you're going to get in so much shit for saying that to feminists, but I wish you would. Have you ever had an argument with a feminist about that?
Actually, I was going to say, as horrible as libertarians have been to me about my feminism.
Well, they'll love that.
They, libertarians have given me a bigger and fairer hearing than feminists ever have.
Oh, really?
Definitely.
What do feminists say to you?
They don't. They will not engage.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that they do engage, it's not intellectual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So give that, I want to hear your version of that argument.
Which
about,
argument?
About feminism taking too much credit for women's, whatever you want to call it, advancement or freedom.
I would say that the real advancement of feminism as a concept that the average American is familiar with at all comes out of the 1970s. And what happened in the 1970s? Stagflation and the shift from manufacturing and agriculture as being the majority of employment to information and services, particularly clerical. Women are better suited to clerical jobs than men are. And because they were seen as female jobs, men didn't want to take them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have two things happening. First, there's greater demand for female labor because families are poorer than they've ever been in the United States. And there's greater opportunity for female labor because the jobs that are being created are particularly well suited to women, better suited to women than American jobs have ever been in history. So you have an unprecedented number of women entering the labor force in a very short period of time in the 1970s. This is borne out in the data. There's no exposure to sexism like the workplace, right? No more important, right? So if you experience sexism in your church, for example, it's unfortunate and unpleasant, but it's kind of neither here nor there. When you experience sexism in the workplace, this is your family, your money, your ability to feed yourself, your ability. You know, sexism in the church has been more patronizing. These women were being sexually harassed. That's a different thing. And so feminism, I believe, arose in popular culture in America in response to women's mass entrance into the labor force, which was driven not by feminism, but by necessity and opportunity. Economic forces created the situation that feminism arose within. Feminism followed these economic forces.
So I can name, probably just off the top of my head, about 6 to 8 prominent, excellent feminist historians who make exactly that argument. So I don't know why feminists don't listen to you when you say this.
Feminists, I don't think, have any problem with this. This is something that I've had much more trouble with conservatives and reactionary libertarians, that they want to blame women's entry into the labor force on feminism. Women don't really want to work. Feminism tells them that they should be working, or
well, that does go on though, doesn't it?
Certainly. Okay. But it's not how it happened for the most part in America.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I also agree with that. I mean, because have you ever read The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan?
I have not.
The famous sort of founding text of second wave feminism, you know?
I'm familiar with it.
Sorry, I should say the founding text for second wave upper middle class white feminism. But the whole, that you should read that, especially, I'll tell you that
I started it.
There's a couple of chapters that everyone should read, which are basically just assaults on sex. The nastiest sort of assault on women's sexuality. And there is a whole chapter devoted to the Lavender Menace, lesbians and gay men she blamed for infantilizing women and over-sexualizing them. And the whole argument of that book is that these housewives have become sex obsessed because they're children perpetually, and because they've been influenced by gay men and become like gay men, who are also perpetual children who are sex obsessed. So you're not going to be a fan of Betty Friedan, but you should read that book. And I do think it informs a whole bunch of feminist thinking. Since then, she also says, and the answer is, of course, to get them into the big jobs, you know, into corporate jobs and politics and all that, right? So it's all about work, 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 and no sex, no sex, no sex. It sucks badly. It's an incredibly terrible book in my view, and it's really the root. But so that's always been there in a lot of feminist thinking, but I think you're right. I just think it's indisputable that it was economic forces driven by the market, essentially, that really made the big change for women and gave millions and millions of women, maybe now billions worldwide, freedom and power. And so it's interesting that two things are happening at the same time, right? You know,
But the
thing that I found in researching, and I was just borrowing from other historians, but looking at sort of early 20th century women who are working for the first time, how sex becomes so important right away, right? Because when you have your own money and you're out of the house and dad's not there and you have no husband yet, kind of like you now, Kathy Reisenwitz, right? In a big city for the first time after living on a goddamn farm in Massachusetts somewhere, right? Guess what you might do, right? And so that's the first sexual revolution, corresponds exactly with the capitalist industrial revolution of the turn of the 20th century. So capitalism was great for women and for, because the same thing happened with gay men and gay women. You're living on a farm in the middle of nowhere. Suddenly there's jobs in a city that you get to go to, and guess who's there? Other gay people that you never knew existed before, right? And so that you have the emergence of the first gay subculture because of capitalism. And this is not a libertarian making these arguments. This is several gay and so-called queer and feminist historians who've been saying this for a long, long time. They've been giving the credit to capitalism without really saying it that way, because you're not allowed to, but that's what it is.
Certainly.
So you actually, without even knowing it, have been making the argument that professional historians have been making for years, right? I mean, you came across this on your own, through your own analysis, without having read that. It's pretty impressive.
I certainly have read things to that effect. I haven't come up with an original thought
right.
yet.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure you've read serious analysis. I'm just saying you haven't read the historical literature probably, because
no.
You're not trained as a historian. Not but I'm saying that's been going on in my field for quite a while.
Most of what I read about how I came to this idea is I was fascinated for probably a year, maybe 6 months to a year with, and I gave a talk about this, at least one, about men's lack of participation in the labor force. So
yeah.
Something like 30% of men between the ages of 18 and 25, I can't remember the specifics, but a crazy number of young men are not in college or in the labor force in America right now.
I know.
And so I was thinking about, what... Again, I don't think that's a culture thing. I think it's an economics thing. And so what economic forces have led to that? And so I started to go back and look at the way the economy, the demand for jobs has impacted culture. And I think we're going through something similar to the way that suddenly women were indispensable to the labor force. Young, low education males have become quite dispensable to the labor force.
My son will become one of those men in a year. I just need to clear my throat. So my son will become one of those men in a year. He'll turn 18 next year, and I'm worried. I'm worried about it.
I'm worried about it too.
And also, especially, and you'll appreciate this, because his mom lives in a suburb, and I mean a really deep, distant suburb of LA, and I live in a town that's an hour from a big city. And so, when he's out of high school, which is coming up, I'm not sure. And he's not going to college next year either. So I'm actually really worried about this, knowing that it's a trend as well, that he's going to end up living at one of our houses and not doing anything.
Right.
Because there's just nothing out there.
Right.
College is too expensive and there are no jobs except for working at Chipotle making burritos.
Right.
For him. At this point, yeah, I'm terrified of it. But so what was how was that connected? You gave a talk about this. How was that connected to what we were talking about?
In that I started looking at the way that demands for labor shape people's...
Social relations.
Absolutely.
Such as this, and gender relations.
Right.
So you know the book, Hannah Rosen's book, The Death or The End of Men?
Yes.
Yeah, right. So what do you think of that? Her argument is basically that women are taking over the professions and have been.
If trends continue, it's been estimated that women will out-earn men by 2025. The average woman will out-earn the average man.
Wow.
If you look at women who don't... The reason that women do not out-earn men now can mostly be traced back to marriage and childbirth. Rates of marriage and childbirth are fairly steady, but... They are declining slightly, and they're definitely being delayed. So if all these trends continue, women are definitely getting more education than men on average. That trend is increasing. So if you continue getting more education continues to become more important to earnings. And the things that have kept women back, marriage and childbirth, are being delayed or foregone.
Mm-hmm.
It will happen. Women will be more economically powerful than men on average.
It seems right now to be, I don't think there's any such thing as an irreversible trend, but I think this is as close as it gets to one. Seems this way. Yeah, I mean, and then college, you haven't talked about that, right? It's like, I think it's getting close to 60% of the student body nationwide is female.
And the big trend that seems irreversible is the trend away from what men have been socialized and are biologically good at. So it would be things that require strength and stamina, physical strength
like
and stamina.
Coal mining and
farming,
logging, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
demand for those roles is diminishing with automation and innovation, and demand for roles where the skill is to be sit down, shut up, and think for hours. Women are good at, mm-hmm. just as good as men, if not better, mm-hmm. And to be pleasant.
Mm.
Men are not as good as women.
Hey, now, easy. You mean they're socialized that way, right?
Men are not socialized to be.
I mean, right. This is
collaborative.
I'm just making sure you're making a socialization argument, not an essentialist argument.
I am not making an essentialist argument.
Right. They're socialized in these respective ways.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, and testosterone is not a hormone that facilitates service jobs.
Maybe. I don't know. I can think of some service jobs it facilitates, but where aggression is required. So what's the answer? Like I have no idea. Do you have an answer?
I do. I have an answer.
Oh, awesome. What
is it? Yeah. So if we want the nuclear family to continue.
Oh, I don't, but go ahead.
I don't either.
Okay.
But should we?
Okay.
The only answer is to put men in the role that women used to fill.
Mm. Just flip it up. Just flip it. Okay.
Yeah.
And what if we don't want the nuclear family?
I'm concerned because...
Oh, so you don't have an answer for that.
I don't have an answer for that. No, I don't. Because...
Because the nuclear family is declining too.
The nuclear family is declining. And being a house husband, being a wife, what a wife used to be, being a stay-at-home dad is something to do, something productive, mm-hmm. something useful.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not doing that, I don't know what these men are going to do.
So this is, even for my generation, it's true, at least, well, this is anecdotal, but it's pretty good sample size. I'd say of all the couples that my girlfriend and I are friends with, which is quite a few because she has a lot of friends and I have some friends too, but we have lots of friends who are couples married with kids or not, who are in their 40s and 50s. I'm talking at least a dozen couples I can think of. I think in almost every case, the woman is the primary breadwinner.
Hmm.
Yep.
Interesting.
And there are several men who are the stay-at-home fathers, but in almost every case, the woman is the primary breadwinner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I just see it all around me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you want the nuclear family, then boys, you better get used to being stay-at-home dads. Sads instead of psalms. Stay-at-home moms. I hated mm-hmm. that when I was in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It was all families, and that's when I discovered that term, SAHM, SOM. It's so sad, but now it's even worse. It is sad, stay-at-home dad. So I'm not into that. The nuclear family's got to go, though, and it is going, and that's what I'm worried about. When that dissolves, and I mean, I want it to dissolve, but and there's no jobs for young men, I don't know. Maybe this is getting exciting. Maybe we'll just see like a new like explosion of a counterculture that's a rebellion against this, you know, like in the 60s perhaps, except 60s. The 60s was driven by economic prosperity. So this, I don't know, it gets a little scarier when it's driven by economic precarity.
Yes.
Right? Which is what we have now.
Yes.
A lot of precarious jobs.
To an extent, I mean, these guys that are not in the labor force and not in school are not starving.
Yeah.
So that's good.
It's interesting.
Well, I think
their parents are feeding them.
Their parents are feeding them. I think
and girlfriends.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
A basic income could be useful.
Yeah, I like that. Do you like that?
I do. I'm a huge fan of a basic income. And the reason I'm a fan of a basic income is not because I want people to be idle. It's because I believe firmly that part of the reason that these men are not involved in something useful is because it's too difficult to get started, especially if you've got a pretty comfy zone that you're getting to operate in. It's like, okay, I live with my parents in a suburb, not a lot of jobs around. I could move to a city where there are jobs, where rent is really high and my pay is going to be really low because my education level is low and my skill level is low. And my taxes are high, you know, payroll tax takes 30% of your income, first dollar earned. We need a way to ease that transition where you can live where you want to live around people that you can do something for and get started.
Right.
And so I see housing policy and basic income as a way to instead of going from, you know, here to here, like low to high, you have to leap, you have to spend, you know, $70,000 getting a bachelor's degree or get a bunch of money from your parents to rent an apartment in a big city, mm-hmm. Or whatever you have to do, you can just kind of start where Americans used to start, where you got an apprenticeship and you know, if you had a basic income, you could volunteer, mm-hmm. right? Instead of going to grad school, you could say, you know, let me just shadow you for free so I can learn how to do this job, which I think would be a much better situation.
I love the idea. I'm just worried that it's going to make us all go broke through the taxation required for it. But I don't know. I haven't studied the economics of it. I want it to work, but I don't know. And I respect the opinion of the people who are skeptical of it. So just on economic terms, but I love the idea of it and I hope it works. So UBI and especially housing policy is what you're doing now.
Right.
So, but I wanted to go back to figure out how you got to that. So you were sort of a traditional or a Republican conservative, which meant that you were sort of nominally at least in favor of markets at the time,
yes.
when you were growing up.
Yes.
So how did you become like a libertarian though? It's a yes. very different animal.
It is. So I took a Constitution and Federalist Papers class in college, which helped me understand the tension between private property and democracy. I'd always been very pro-democracy because I assumed everyone thought, or most, at least all Republicans, thought as I did, that private property was sacrosanct and innovation is important. But as it turns out, people will vote themselves other people's property pretty much every time you let them. And so the founding fathers were very skeptical of democracy too, which is why America was a lot less democratic when mm-hmm. it was founded. So that was the beginning. And then I started reading Reason Magazine.
Hmm. How did that happen?
I don't remember.
Because it's not around a lot.
You know what? Actually, no. I think I found Ron Paul first.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was just YouTube. I don't know. Hmm. I don't remember how I found Ron Paul. But I was always politically... You know what it was? I was addicted to Drudge Report.
Oh my God.
I loved Fox News and Drudge Report. I used to read Ann Coulter unironically. I wanted to be Ann Coulter.
I used to read Ann Coulter unironically. That's a line right there.
I loved her. And she's hilarious. I'll give her that.
Yeah. yeah.
And so, yeah, it was probably covered by Drudge. Mm-hmm. So I found Ron Paul. I started listening to him and I was like, he's definitely wrong about some things, but he's making a lot of sense about competition and markets and mm-hmm. private property and sound money.
Yep.
And I was, I think, posting on Facebook about Ron Paul, and my friend from high school, Marcia, said, if you like Ron Paul, you might like Mises and Reason, and linked me to Mises and Reason. I started reading them both at the same time. And again, I was like, well, I love them on this innovation and competition stuff and this private property. This drug war stuff and, you know, pro-sex stuff. I'm like, I don't know about all that.
How did you reconcile your sex obsession? Were you sort of conscious of your of being highly interested in sex?
I'm going to tell you, it was a couple years ago when I really started to internalize that other people are not as interested in sex as I am.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, I just thought...
Well, is this true? I mean, I wonder this all the time myself, like, because I've thought of myself as being sex obsessed, because it just seems like other people are less interested than I am. But I don't know if that's really true. I mean, Freud thinks it's not true. Freud thinks that everybody's obsessed all the time. And a lot of psychoanalysts think that everybody's sex obsessed all the time too.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It certainly doesn't look that way to me.
I think it's true. I think most people are just not...
What's your evidence for that?
Just talking to them.
Yeah?
Yeah, just talking to them.
Are you talking about women, men, both, either?
Both.
Both? Really?
Absolutely.
I think you're wrong about men. I hope you're wrong about women. Really? So what do you hear from them that leads you to believe that they think about sex less than you do?
I'll ask them a question that I've thought a lot about, and they'll have never thought about it.
Like what? What kind of question?
That's a good, yeah. I don't
see, because people don't talk about sex, even if they're into sex.
And that was always my assumption, is that people are thinking about it just as much as I am. They're just not talking about it. But I guess meeting people who are uninhibited.
Yeah.
Who they're just not wrapped around the axle about it. Like,
well, we are sitting about, what is it, about 10 blocks from the, it used to be, I don't think, I think, no, it's used to be, it just closed, about 10 blocks from the world headquarters of kink.com.
Correct.
Right. I think they just moved there, right? But they used to be right down the street. We're on the same street, in fact. Weren't they on Mission? We're on Mission Street in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So San Francisco is weird in that way, right? Because it's got the whole kink subculture, it's got the gay subculture, but then it's got this massive work dominant culture now,
right?
Which is what you're a part of as well. So there's a tension there. I mean, work and sex don't go well together, do they?
I think I'll put it to you this way. You know how some people are foodies,
mm-hmm.
right?
There's a lot of those here too.
Thought a lot about food.
Yep.
They feel strongly about food.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy a good meal, you know? Mm-hmm. I like to eat. I have to eat.
Okay.
I have the urge to eat. And when I eat, I feel better. I am not a foodie. Like, I don't think about food very much.
I see.
Beyond, like, my weight, yeah. right? But, like, I don't go to the grocery store and, like, plan my meals and get excited about a meal. Mm-hmm. I think that's analogous, that I think yep. about sex the way foodies think about food.
Right. You enjoy food while you're eating it, but then you don't think about it afterward.
Not much.
Right.
I think that's how most people are.
I don't know.
That's
a great question. I mean, I know there have been lots of studies done, which I haven't read on this, but, you know, I've always been of the mind that the psychoanalysts were essentially correct, that what's going on most of the time in people's minds is either thinking about sex or actively repressing thoughts about sex, right? The repression is sexual too.
Certainly.
Right. And so I think the repression is constant. And so I would consider that to be sexual, but I don't know. I mean, I also don't want to make claims about people's consciousness. It seems to be what goes on, but I don't know. So you became a libertarian sort of in college, and then you got this job at Reason.
I did.
Yeah. Good magazine. I've heard about it.
Yeah.
And they hired you, and you went to DC to work there as a marketer, right, for them?
Yes.
But you didn't want to do marketing.
No.
You wanted to be a big fancy public intellectual, correct?
I wanted to be a pundit.
Pundit, I know. But yeah. It's a stupid word, though. Why do you want to be a pundit?
Oh, I would much rather call myself a pundit than a public intellectual.
Why?
That makes me want to die.
Come on now. That's like reverse snobbery. What's wrong with being an intellectual?
I would love nothing more, but I could never call myself that.
Oh, you don't think you're worthy of it?
It's just cringy.
Why?
It's like calling yourself beautiful. It's just something.
What's wrong with that?
It's not likable.
Come on now. I think that's contradictory to the rest of your philosophy.
How so?
I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
Okay. So you moved to DC. You want to be a pundit.
Yes.
You want to be talking on Fox News with Ann Coulter.
Yes.
And other people, right? And
absolutely.
And writing articles and op-eds and...
But mostly writing, yeah.
Being in the media and mm-hmm. doing that. And what did you want to write about?
All the shit I've been thinking about.
But, sex and sexuality and all this?
My goal was to sell libertarianism mm-hmm. to a wider audience. So I thought libertarianism was... I still do. I think when it comes to policy, libertarians have the best ideas. The most fact-based, the most mm-hmm. useful.
Mm-hmm.
If what you want is economic growth and innovation, libertarianism, of all the kind of mainstream major strains of political thought, offers the most useful solutions.
Yep.
And so I wanted to take people on the same journey I went on
mm-hmm.
through my writing.
Right. So gender and sexuality were not at the top of your mind yet.
No, not at all.
And how did that happen?
I had no idea how regressive libertarianism was.
Ah, okay.
I didn't know. And I think...
You mean not the ideology, you mean the people.
The people.
Who were espousing it at that time.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And it's changed quite a bit since you came around.
It has.
5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah. It has. The alt-right's the best thing that's ever happened to libertarianism.
Oh, yeah?
Definitely.
When you're hiring, there are job sites that send you tons of the wrong resumes to sort through. That's not smart. But you know what is smart? going to ZipRecruiter.com/Russell to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and then actively invites them to apply, so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the United States. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Russell. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Russell. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/RUSSELL. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Okay, so first of all, so tell us about these libertarian men that you encountered when you got there to DC.
I'd always, you know, libertarianism for me was somewhat Mises, but mostly reason. And reason is not, certainly wasn't, like in the 90s and 2000s, right wing, or didn't seem like it to me. As a right winger, it seemed like, whoa, you know, super lefty. So
on cultural issues, right?
On cultural issues. Right. And so, you know, I wasn't like a Tom Woods listener. You know, I wasn't into that Mayhew. And so I came to DC and started writing about libertarianism. And I would mostly writing about, again, not for a libertarian audience, but trying to reach people on the left and right. But I would just say like a thing that I thought was uncontroversial, like, you know, women are people. Or I would identify as a feminist. And people would just lose their minds in a way that I didn't anticipate. It didn't make any sense to me. So I began very quickly to see libertarian reactionaryism, libertarian cultural conservatism, libertarian bigotry as one of the biggest hindrances to mass adoption of libertarianism's good ideas.
So, you know, we have, I think, a mutual friend, Angela Keaton?
Yes.
Do you know, okay. Do you know Angela?
I do.
Okay, yeah. So she was on the show and we talked about this a lot. She talks about this topic a lot, sexism within libertarianism.
Right.
Right. And I don't know most of the people she's talking about at all because it's mostly sort of like beltway libertarians and people I don't deal with, right? And I just don't know what goes on, but you kind of were inside of it. So what specifically, like, what would you encounter? What was sexist about it? What were they doing, saying? How were they behaving?
And this wasn't really beltway libertarians, a little bit here and there, but mostly in the course of trying to sell libertarianism to a wider audience, I gained an audience of libertarians online. You know, they'd comment and, it would just be like feminazi, you know, I heard over and over and over again, there's nothing incompatible between libertarianism and racism, and there's nothing incompatible between libertarianism and sexism. It was very important to these people that they be allowed to be libertarians and racist and sexist. Explicitly, they said it explicitly, and not explicitly, right? But so in many, many different ways, I encountered this.
So this is, I think there was this argument about thick libertarianism versus thin. This is relevant, right?
Absolutely.
So thin is just the thin libertarian doesn't mean that you're thin. It means that you're interested. You think libertarianism should only be concerned with economics and the state.
Right.
Right. And so all other questions are irrelevant. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thick libertarians doesn't mean you're thick. It means you think that cultural freedom of the sorts you're talking about are as important as economics in the state to libertarianism, or should be.
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
Yeah. I don't even know what I think about that.
I'll tell you, it goes back to what we were talking about.
Since I'm not a libertarian, I don't give a shit. Like, I don't care what y'all do and how you brand this thing, but like, I agree with the thicks, you know, on these questions, generally speaking. I just, you know, but I don't want to identify either way. I don't really care, but I just, on those issues, I tend to agree with you guys. That's all. but
I don't think it's a useful distinction. Mm-hmm. I think, like we were talking about, like love is transactional, right? Mm-hmm. I view everything through this, through the lens of economics. Uh-huh. Everything is exchange. And so to make this difference between how is it not economic that at a point in history, there were stretches of highway where Black people could not buy gas.
Right.
How is that not economics?
Right.
Right?
Right.
And so to tell me...
Well, yeah. Because, well, that was by state law.
Right.
I mean, some of it was. And some of it was just gas station, private gas station owners choosing not to. But by far, most of it was state law. But still, there were some private gas station owners that refused to serve Blacks in the South before 1965. So, I mean, the thin libertarians would say to you, right, well, if it's fine for a private actor to do it, I hope they would say it's not okay for the state to discriminate. Did they think it was okay for the state to have racist laws?
Now, they would say that for some reason, the ability to refuse to serve Black people is, and it's a property right. And so that, but that's not, it's not more or less economics to say, it's important that in a society, a business owner have the right to refuse service. It's just as much an economics question to say, is it important in a society that a person be able to avail themselves of a certain product?
Right. Okay. So there's legal freedom and then there's cultural freedom, right? There's freedom, economics as a legal doctrine. Economic freedom is a legal doctrine, and then there's economic freedom as a cultural norm. Is that what you're getting at here?
Sure.
So in other words, if I were a gas station owner in Alabama in 1956 or whatever, and I refused, and there was no law one way or the other, but I refused to serve Negroes, right? What would you say to me, or what would you have to say about me? That I should do that because it serves economic freedom, that I should serve Negroes because it serves economic freedom, and you support, libertarians should support a libertarian culture, in addition to libertarian policies?
Well, yeah, it's like, is the goal limited government for the sake of limited government? Or is the goal limited government for some higher end? And for me, there's no question. Like, limited government is a tool toward human flourishing and prosperity specifically, right? I want more innovation. I want us to stop arguing about scarcity because scarcity doesn't exist anymore. Like, that's my goal. Mm-hmm. Libertarianism is a tool toward that goal. And so part of that goal is, if we want innovation and prosperity, every person, regardless of skin color, should be able to access the goods and services that they need to be prosperous.
Right.
Right. And
so
to me, libertarianism for the purpose of limited government is so stupid, it's not worth talking about.
Good. Yeah. The objective is prosperity, dipshits. Right?
Yes.
Yes. Freedom and then prosperity.
Yes.
That's right. And you're not going to get it if you don't allow 12% of your population to drive on the fucking roads.
For no fucking purpose.
Right. Yeah. You know, Truman solved that part of that problem, you know, for the military, because they had this problem. They were like, damn, our military is not strong enough in 1947 to take on the Soviet Union. And if we ever go to World War III. And so they said, oh, yeah, you know what? We have 12% of the population that can serve in the army. So they integrated the combat forces in the military. Right. Great. Fantastic. Libertarians didn't get the same message, unfortunately, until very recently. I love that. That's good. So I guess what you would say to the gas station owner is, if you would like a society that is more prosperous, right? Not just your gas station, but the society you live in to be more prosperous,
right?
It would serve your own interest.
Certainly.
To serve Negroes on this road.
Certainly.
Is that correct? I like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I would say
I like that.
That
a lot.
I would also say, I think, you know, to the extent that you encourage that gas station owner to, I would also say, even more importantly, a lot of libertarians want to say the profit motive alone is enough to solve racism and sexism. And that's not even close to true.
Nope.
I mean, there are two problems at play here. First is that people are not rational decision makers, right? So even if it were, first of all, it's not always true. Like, there are people who will frequent a business because it's racist, right? And so it being more profitable to be less racist would require there to be a lot less racists.
Right.
And there aren't. There are a lot of racists. But then also, people are not rational. And so even if it were true that it were always more profitable to be racist, people have demonstrated time and time again that they have been racist, even though it unambiguously made them poorer. Mm-hmm. So the idea that if we get government out of the way, racism will go away is absolutely absurd. Market forces created racism. Mm-hmm. Government helped it, but people's preferences are a problem for prosperity.
Yeah, that's a great argument. So the sexism the anti-feminism and defensive racism that you experienced when you became a pundit came mostly from so-called non-name libertarians. Is that right? It sounds like.
Oh yeah, certainly. Oh,
okay, so there's nobody at a think tank did any of this to you or said anything to you along these lines or treated you. I was wondering if you were treated in a sexist way by people in sort of high positions in the libertarian movement.
Oh, certainly.
Oh,
certainly.
Like what? I mean, you don't have to name names. You can if you want, but like, how are you treated differently?
She's apologized, so I'm not going to name her name, but there was an article written about me by another libertarian female about how I and others use our boobs to sell liberty.
What? I missed this one. How did I miss this one? It's like all my favorite things in one article.
It was strange from start to finish, not least because I don't have any boobs.
Yeah, right. You're like, you're completely wrong, idiot. I have no boobs. Next question.
Which, you know, maybe explains our low adoption rates. I don't know. They should have hired someone with bigger assets.
I don't get it. Okay, that's it?
Yeah, I mean, I have not really had a bad time. I was treated real well in D.C. I love D.C.
Okay.
I was treated very well by the.
I certainly hope the reason people weren't sexist toward you.
No,
because those are my friends. You
absolutely
know?
Yeah, not.
I wouldn't think so.
Not at Cato. No.
Okay.
I was treated very well.
Yeah.
If anything, I was given opportunities. Because I was female.
Right. So you were around, and you were getting a lot of attention, at least within that little political. Or that little slice of American political life, and a lot of it negative, some of it positive. You know, I liked what you were doing for the most part. And then that stopped happening. You stopped working at Reason and you kind of dropped out of politics for a while, right?
So I stopped working at Reason after a year. And then I freelanced for a bit and I had a little YouTube show that started while I was at Reason. Mm-hmm. That was fun. And then I got hired by Students for Liberty. Actually, this was the funnest job I ever had.
Oh, yeah?
I did the best work I've ever done. Yes. So we started a program called Young Voices. It was a program of Students for Liberty. And the purpose was to find people kind of like me, like youngish, younger than me mostly, people who were libertarians and wanted to help sell liberty to the wider world. So they would write op-eds and I would edit them and pitch them to major publications, also media appearances.
Hmm.
So I did that for a year and it was awesome.
Yeah.
Really good time.
Okay. And then what happened?
I just wasn't making any money.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was 28. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, I kind of need to be making money.
Right.
So, and I love a fight. I love a fight. And if you want to make money as a libertarian pundit or a conservative pundit or a liberal, whatever kind of pundit you want to make money as, you don't make money by telling your ideological.
Preaching to the choir.
You make money by preaching to the choir.
Or you do make money by preaching to the choir.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Instead of fighting with the other camp.
So you fight with the other camp and you preach to your camp and that's how you make money and that's how you are well-liked.
Right.
I thought, I can't. Like, A, that's super fucking boring. I find critiques of other ideologies very boring because they're generally terribly informed, like not very well informed. You don't understand what you're critiquing. Straw manning an ideological opponent is the most boring shit I can imagine. And telling people that they're right is also the most boring shit I can possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at libertarianism and I'm saying, this is a flawed product. You know, when I went to DC, I was like, this is a great product and I want to sell it. When I got to DC, I realized this product is not selling because it's not ready for sale. We're not ready for prime time.
What was wrong with it?
It was racist and sexist.
Oh, that part. Yes. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that didn't. Okay. Yeah. Right.
And so I was like, well, okay, I find these critiques, these arguments much more interesting than arguing with like, oh, you should like innovation or, you know, you should be less Republican. You know, I found those arguments really interesting, and I found the task of trying to make libertarianism better interesting for a while. But then for the money I was making and the headache I was receiving, it just wasn't worth it to me to continue anymore. And I also, I really underestimated the, I didn't see myself as having the capacity to be an expert on anything, right? It's, a pundit is not, sometimes they're experts, but I wasn't. I was a mile wide and an inch deep.
But that could change. In fact, it did change.
It
are,
did change.
You are an expert on housing policy.
Exactly.
Now. Yeah.
But I wasn't ready for that. So I left because I didn't want to do that anymore,
okay.
But I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I knew I wanted to make money.
Okay.
So I publicly quit libertarianism, got a for-profit job, and, you know, made real friends for the first time.
Hmm.
I had the time and energy to go deep with a few people instead of flitting around and trying to, like, you know, network constantly.
Yeah. Right.
To make a name for myself. I was hustling hard for, you know, 2-3 years. And so not doing that was a really nice reprieve.
Mm-hmm. And then some boy came along that got you here. Is this correct?
So we dated in high school.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Okay.
And then had reconnected. And we dated long distance. He was in San Francisco. I was in DC. And I was also dating another guy long distance in San Francisco.
And everybody knew all about this.
Everybody knew
because
everything.
You're part of this polyamory thing.
This polyamory thing.
Okay.
Which started in DC. Yeah. He invited me to live out in San Francisco and I with him. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. This was a year and a half of I don't know. And then I was just kind of ready, you know? I'd been in DC for 5 years. I wasn't working in politics. I liked San Francisco. It seemed like a cooler city.
Mm, it is.
It is. It's a cooler
it
city.
It was before you ruined it by coming here.
Doing my best.
And working in tech.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then that didn't work out once you got here.
No.
The boy part.
I tried.
Right.
I gave it my honest.
The transaction was not satisfying your needs, correct?
No, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, you've written about this in your blog. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading.
Well, I thought I was coming out here to build something with him.
Oh.
Right?
Oh, I didn't know that. There was a project or a business or something?
I didn't know what it was, right? I didn't know if it was going to be a project or a business, but it was a life.
Okay.
I thought we were building a life together.
Oh, like with a family and stuff?
Maybe.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe a business.
In an unaffordable house.
Right.
Is
right.
That,
but I wanted a partner, and I thought that was what he wanted as well.
A life partner.
A life partner.
Permanent.
I did.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
Heartbreaking, huh?
It was disappointing.
Must have been worse than that. You had moved all the way out here, changed, you've upended your life. You get here, you think you're going to be with this guy forever, and it turns out he's not into it.
Yeah. It was one of those things where I could not imagine anyone could be so fickle, cruel, unself-aware.
Mm.
So I wouldn't accept it. It was very clear from the start, but I just wouldn't accept it.
To yourself?
To myself.
You were denying it to yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
For a
while.
Year.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I'm not. I'm glad.
I'm not. I love it here.
Because you're free.
Yeah.
Because look, now you're in San Francisco, working downtown San Francisco, and you're free.
Yeah.
There you go. Got your own money, just like those women in the 1880s, and you can do what you want. You go to Coney Island, except it's not here, but yeah. So, all right. So let's do the housing thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I've been following you guys because it's a group of you, uh-huh. right? You YIMBYs. And yes. there's an organization or organizations and there's publications. And
oh,
There's a thing going on here in San Francisco among you YIMBYs that a lot of people don't know
there's
about.
There's like 3 podcasts.
It's amazing.
At least.
Right. No one knows about this.
And a Georgism podcast.
And what?
And there's a Georgism podcast.
Georgism?
Yes.
You mean like Henry Georgism?
Uh-huh.
Oh, but God, what's going on in this world? You kids these days. Uh-huh. No, but I've been sort of watching you guys from outside because I'm from here, so I'm interested in it, you know? And, but a lot of people don't know about this, so I really want to give, and I fully support you, and I think you're completely correct about this, and I want to give it as much voice as possible. So that's one of the reasons I'm talking to you. But so let's do this. You have somebody running for the Board of Supervisors.
Yes. Sonia Trauss.
Sonia Trauss, who would not come on this podcast, Sonia. No, I think she would, but only for, she said something like, but only for 10 minutes. And I'm like, come on. I'm going to talk to Kathy instead. She's more interesting. Yeah. So Sonia's, so lay it out. No one knows shit about this. So why is San Francisco so expensive? What are you guys proposing and what's going on?
Well, I'll tell you my story first.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about the overview of the situation. So I was in DC and I read the New York Times profile of Sonia Trauss.
Oh.
So this was when I still lived in DC.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this bitch is badass.
And
like,
who is she?
She, at the time, was a public school teacher, I want to say, maybe a private school teacher. Yeah, she has a degree in economics. She was teaching math to school children, and she was just like, why is San Francisco so expensive? And she started to look into it and realized, you know, people here don't understand the law of supply and demand.
A city full of capitalists.
Yeah.
Right. It's true. They don't understand supply and demand. Basic stuff.
Basic stuff, yeah.
And then it's either capitalists and Marxists. That's who lives here.
Right.
And neither one of them. Both are obsessed with economics, and neither one of them understands supply and demand. I'm not kidding you.
No.
When I tell my Marxist friends in Berkeley and my Marxist family from Berkeley, they're like, it's because of tech. It's because of rich people.
Right.
It's because of you. It's because they have no clue
that
it's these regulations that are causing this. But continue.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she was like, well, the solution's obvious. We should build more housing.
Mm-hmm.
And then she looked into why that wasn't happening. And she just started going to meetings and hearings. So in order to get a building built in San Francisco, especially if people intend to live in it, you have to go to hearings. We don't have by right permitting like most of the rest
of
the country.
You have to go to hearings to build a building?
You have to inform the community around the potential. So you have to buy the land.
Okay.
Then you have to submit your permit. Then you have to send mailers out to everyone who lives around where you want to build and give them the opportunity, several opportunities, to have a hearing, to do a CEQA review, which is an environmental review, which is actually used by neighbors who want to block buildings to mm-hmm. lengthen the process and get concessions. So she started showing up. And she started making a stink, and she started organizing people who also saw the problem. And that started as SF BARF, Bay Area Renters Federation. So it was, I don't know if it was quite YIMBY yet. I think it might have been still BARF when I read that profile. But I was like, okay, so she's a woman who's politically active, who understands supply and demand, who is advocating for private property rights in the Bay Area, a place that's not... you know, traditionally super friendly to uh-huh. private property. I got to meet her. If mm-hmm. I ever move out to San Francisco, I'm definitely going to be best friends with Sonia Trauss. So I moved out and I went to my first SF YIMBY happy hour where I met Diego, who's the editor of the Bay City Beacon.
Yes, in my backyard, just for those of you who don't know what we're talking about here. YIMBY, yes, instead of NIMBY, no, in my backyard.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. And you met who?
Diego, my editor at the Bay City Beacon.
Okay, Bay City Beacon, what is this? I had never heard of this.
Yeah, it's paper. Only been around like a year and a half.
Okay.
But we are the only moderate news source in San Francisco.
What does that mean? I hate that word.
I do too.
Good.
So in San Francisco...
What does it really mean?
It means we understand supply and demand.
Means that you have sort of a libertarian-ish take on economics by San Francisco standards.
I am an outlier among YIMBYs as having any kind of libertarian.
Interesting.
Yes. Most YIMBYs are not.
Because it's a pretty straight up libertarian cause, you would think.
Absolutely. And it's the only thing we all agree on.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
That's good. That's
absolutely
great. Coalition. Beautiful example of coalition building.
I mean, after being in the libertarian bubble for so long.
It's fantastic. I didn't know this. I assumed that many of you would have been libertarians. And so you're the only one, pretty much.
Not the only one, but one of few.
Most of them are just good old Berkeley and San Francisco progressive types?
Yeah.
Wow. Good for them.
Yeah.
Huh. No kidding. Mm-hmm. And? But so it's not just those. Aren't there other regulations? It's not just that they give basic veto power to the neighborhoods. Aren't there other blocks to building?
So the two biggest blocks to building in San Francisco are the discretionary review and zoning.
Mm, right.
So
what's the discretionary review? I don't know about this.
Absolutely. And I didn't know anything about it before I came out here.
Yeah.
But discretionary review means you need to jump through a bunch of hurdles before you're allowed. Essentially, you need the permission of your neighbors to build housing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that other places in the country are less NIMBY. Nobody wants new neighbors anywhere, pretty much. It's just that most places understand that if you give people the power to block building, they will do it.
Right.
And San Francisco has decided that that's a good idea. So we have discretionary review. And so that makes building incredibly expensive. It doesn't stop building. And we've built much less than we should have. But even more pernicious than that is that the only kind of housing that gets built has to be a certain amount of expensive to pencil out.
Hmm.
You cannot, because of the review process, right? Because we have inclusionary zoning as well. So that means a certain percentage of your units have to be offered at below market rates.
Mm.
Adds to the cost of building.
Mm-hmm.
Our labor is particularly expensive mm-hmm. in San Francisco.
Yep.
The land is expensive. And then you add on top of that the years-long discretionary review process where you've got, you know, lawyers and you're paying a mortgage on the land while it's not being used profitably, mm-hmm. while you navigate the maze of bureaucracy, right? All this adds to the cost of housing. So you cannot profitably build low-income housing in this schema.
Right. So I grew up in Berkeley in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And all through that time, when you would drive across the Bay Bridge or look at San Francisco from across the bay, the only skyscrapers that were really recognizable or noticeable, there were just two skyscrapers, really. I mean, there may have been others, but they were much smaller. But you really saw the Bank of America building, and you saw the Transamerica Pyramid, which is very famous, right? And just yesterday, when I was driving into the city, I came in from the south, which I usually don't do, instead of from Berkeley, and I could not see either the Bank of America building or the Transamerica Pyramid at all until I was halfway across the Bay Bridge, at which point I could see just the very tip top of the Transamerica. And I still couldn't, I never could see the Bank of America building, which used to be the tallest building in San Francisco through my entire childhood. Okay, so obviously they've been building a whole lot of big, there's just massive skyscrapers all around where we're sitting right now that didn't exist 10 years ago. So clearly they've been doing a lot of vertical building here, but I'm assuming it's all for offices because
right.
Google is here and everybody's here, right?
Right.
And my parents used to live in this neighborhood in South of Market and until Twitter moved in next door to them. But that's all downtown.
Right.
So if anybody knows what San Francisco looks like, what you see at the foot of the Bay Bridge is the downtown, and that's where all the skyscrapers are. If you take the big view of San Francisco and look where the Golden Gate is, that's that whole area between downtown, basically, and the ocean is what we call the avenues, and it's the Sunset and the Richmond districts. And if you look at that, the entire thing looks like Washington, D.C., which is that nothing is more than, what is it, 30 or 40 feet high. It's just these single-family homes forever and ever and ever and ever. So you have these massive downtown, this downtown that now looks like Shanghai, almost. And then you have this huge chunk of land in western San Francisco that is nothing but these tiny single-family houses, right?
Right.
And this is, I guess, and so it pisses me off, basically, when I saw that, because I'm like, oh, so they're allowing massive skyscrapers to be built for Google and Twitter, but they won't allow building for people to live in.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So that's what you're doing. You're attacking that. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So, and verticality is key here, obviously.
Absolutely.
Right.
Right. Build up.
Yeah. When you drive into Vancouver, you ever been to Vancouver?
I have not.
So, I mean, I get it aesthetically.
Sure.
I get it. You know, when you drive into Vancouver, I was slightly, I wouldn't say horrified, but there's all these giant apartment buildings mm-hmm. all around downtown, I think downtown Vancouver, sort of core Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them look kind of cheap. You mm-hmm. know, they're not particularly nice looking. I mean, the skyscrapers here that are kind of gloriously beautiful in some ways, mm-hmm. you know, they're not so pretty in Vancouver, and they're really tall and they dominate the skyline. But, you know, I bet you anything their rents are cheaper.
Right.
And I bet it's easier for people like you to live in Vancouver than in San Francisco. In fact, we know this. But the idea of the Sunset and the Richmond districts, which each, I don't know, how long is that? How many miles, square miles is that? It's a big chunk of land. The idea of huge apartment buildings all around there. You know, I have mixed feelings because I grew up here and I have a great love for that area in Golden Gate Park, which is right in the middle of mm-hmm. it. And, the view of the Golden Gate Bridge looking at the city from there it's gorgeous. You know, it's the most beautiful city in the country, basically, you mm-hmm. know? So you're going to ruin that.
I'm hoping to.
Yeah. No, but I mean, it seems... Okay, so what are the arguments against you guys that have been made? Are there any arguments or do they just call you names?
Oh, yeah, no, I mean...
I can't even imagine what an argument would be except an aesthetic one. The aesthetic argument makes sense to me, right? You would grant that, wouldn't you? Or do you agree with that aesthetic? I mean, that's just a value, aesthetic value. Do you think it would be less attractive as a city physically?
I enjoy the look of Victorians, but I can't... to even have that argument is intellectually offensive and morally offensive.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about homelessness. We're talking about the opportunity of people like me to leave their hometowns and make a way for themselves, to fully participate in the market economy, to have a chance at the American dream, like all of that, you know, to get out of the repression that they're dealing with, right? San Francisco mm-hmm. is supposed to be a welcoming place, and we've made it impossible.
Where did you get that funny idea?
Right. We've made it impossible for all but the richest to live here and to say, but my aesthetics, like I'm offended mm-hmm. by that idea. Mm-hmm. I find that repulsive. But I would say the better arguments, the probably the most compelling argument is that zoning results from racism, right? This is unambiguous. Hmm. Zoning
even here?
Absolutely.
How so? I don't know about this.
You can actually look at the west side is zoned single family homes.
Right.
The east side is zoned commercial and
there's public housing on the east side.
And there's public housing and there's...
I used to live right next door to projects in the Lower Haight. Yeah.
And so, yeah, the purpose of the zoning was to exclude black and brown people. Mm-hmm. There was Asian neighborhoods and white neighborhoods,
right.
And they had single family homes
yep.
because that's what those families could afford. And there weren't, they did not allow apartments. They did not allow, you'll see them occasionally, but for the most part, they're single family homes for the purpose of exclusion. So,
boy, that's a powerful argument, you would think, around here against zoning.
You would think. But the reality is that just about every new multifamily building that goes up in San Francisco goes up on the east side.
Right.
So,
which is, that's for people who don't know, that's where we are. That's basically downtown and sort of the fancy neighborhoods, right? That's the, like, not Noe Valley, but sort of. This whole downtown area, South of Market, Nob Hill, North Beach, that area.
Sure.
The famous parts of San Francisco that people know about.
Sure, but yeah. where the housing goes is the Mission.
Yeah.
Tenderloin.
Right.
Soma. So these are the poorer person of color heavier mm-hmm. areas of San Francisco.
Yeah, right.
So the majority richer homeowner white and Asian areas don't get new apartments. The places in San Francisco that get new apartments are majority minority mm-hmm. And lower income and higher renter density. So the rich white homeowners don't get displaced by new building. the people who get displaced by new building are poorer, more likely to be people of color, more financially precarious people. Mm-hmm. They're the ones whose apartments get turned into condos. Mm. They're the ones whose apartments get torn down and turned into high rises. Like, they're the ones who, they're going along, they can afford the restaurants around their apartments, and then suddenly they can't because a bunch of rich white tech workers have moved in, and now, you know, there's a Brewcade and a sushi place, and they're the ones who bear the brunt of progress because of A, zoning, and B, discretionary review. Even in areas that are zoned for multifamily, rich white homeowners show up to these meetings and say, you know, we can't have this in this area, and they hire lawyers and they sue to stop development. Poor minority renters have done it amazingly, but it's harder for them, obviously, to fight development. It's harder for them to effectively NIMBY. And so this is, I think, the most compelling argument against building more housing in San Francisco the way it is currently done. To me, it's an argument for ending discretionary review and abolishing zoning. But if you can't do that, then I understand why people would want to yell, like, stop, you know, fucking up our communities. Stop making it impossible for us to live here. Because we're the ones getting displaced. The rich white homeowners aren't getting displaced. I'm not displacing, you know, people who own a home here.
Right.
I'm displacing renters.
Yeah. So what is the, I mean, again, I asked you what arguments have been made against you. I haven't heard any. What do they say? Why should the Sunset and Richmond districts be nothing but little stucco one family houses that can house at most 10 people each?
I think their argument is less that. Their argument is like, why should we let you? Why should we let you displace us? Mm. Like, why shouldn't we NIMBY just as hard as the hard as we can?
Okay.
We'll never NIMBY as hard as the rich white people, but we're going to do what we can to protect ourselves from you.
Yeah.
And I'm sympathetic to an extent.
Right. But the hypocrisy of progressives who make that argument, right? If you're not a progressive, if you're not speaking for the people and you claim to be concerned about marginalized populations, et cetera, right? Fine. You know, be honest, that's great. But that's not most San Franciscans. Most San Franciscans, you know, care really deeply about marginalized people while they're doing these things to keep them broke and displaced and in suburbs 50 miles from here. People, the Mexicans who clean their toilets, they spend 2 to 3 hours, right, commuting into the city to get here because they have to live so far from here.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't hear much except for hypocrisy from these people.
They make arguments that building more increases rents. Not true.
But, I mean, how could that possibly be? I mean, there's no economist would ever agree with that.
There are economist adjacent people who...
Economist adjacent.
Yeah.
Who are well paid.
Yeah. They have their arguments.
So Sonia Trauss is running for Board of Supervisors right now.
Correct.
The election is in a few weeks. It's the same day as everyone else. Yeah. And does she have a chance of winning?
I think so.
Really? I don't know. I haven't followed it.
I wouldn't have thought so. But she's not polling great, but I think it's possible.
Which douchebag is she running against?
His name is Matt Haney.
And we hate him. Vote for Sonia Trauss if you live here. You probably don't live here, so if you're listening to this. But
give her money.
Give her money. There you go.
Yeah,
give her money.
Give her money.
Sonia Trauss.
Give YIMBY money.
TRAUSS. YIMBY is the name of the organization?
Yes.
Okay.
SFYIMBY.
SFYIMBY, and you guys have a website?
Yes.
Support this, seriously. So my son is a chef. He's 17. He can cook a five-star meal, great meal, right? And my parents live right across the bay, you know, and I'm from here. And this, of course, is the foodie capital. I know you don't give a shit, but like it's a foodie capital. It's the foodie capital still. But he can't, you know, 10, 20 years ago, it would have been obvious for him what to do. It would be to move back to my hometown, right? And live here and work in a restaurant. And back then, 20 years ago, at least, he could have afforded it. Like
Absolutely.
I did. I lived here 20 years ago. On very, very little money. He can't anymore. So if you guys win, he will have a chance. So I got some skin in this game.
Absolutely.
I'm with you. So God damn it. Donate to SFYIMBY and support Sonia Trauss and everything Kathy Reisenwitz says about this and does about this. So you started in Birmingham, Alabama, right?
I did.
You born and raised there?
Born and raised in Huntsville, Alabama, 2 hours north.
Huntsville, north of what?
Birmingham.
Oh, right. I said you're from Birmingham. That's right. You're from Huntsville. What's in Huntsville? I don't know Huntsville.
Rocket City.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Y'all make rockets down there?
Yep.
What kind of rockets?
Space rockets.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Is that okay? Like NASA rockets?
NASA rockets and missile defense.
Is that what your parents were involved in?
Yes. My dad is a missile defense person.
What does he do?
He sells weapon systems or defense systems. I'm not actually 100% sure.
But he's in sales?
He is involved in the coordination of the U.S. government and other governments and the missile defense systems of those.
But he doesn't make them. He's not an engineer. He's involved.
He's a mechanical engineer.
Oh, he is an engineer. Mm-hmm. So he's involved in making them.
Presumably.
Missile defense. So when the Russians actually do launch the nukes, his missiles will save us. Is that the idea here?
Here's hoping.
Is that really it? Like interceptor missiles?
I believe so.
You believe so. Okay. You need to talk to your dad more.
He is not allowed to talk to me.
Are you serious?
These things. Yeah.
Oh, not allowed. Oh, yeah. Right. Of course. Because that would be national security.
Right.
Right. And what kind of a family besides that was it?
It's interesting because Huntsville has, due to missile defense and space, a lot of people who are not from the South. Mm-hmm. So neither of my parents are Southern.
And why you have no accent?
And why I have no accent. Why,
sorry, you do have an accent. You don't have a Southern accent.
Right. If anything, it's a little, it gets more Southern when I talk about the South sometimes, mm-hmm. or get drunk. but yeah, everybody's like, you don't have an accent. Mm-hmm. If I'd known how attractive people would find it out of the South, I might have tried harder to get one.
Well, we find it attractive and endearing the way we find children to be attractive and endearing. You know, the Northern condescension towards Southerners.
Certainly.
Yeah, it's grotesque.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really grotesque. But I have to say, it's really deeply inborn in me, because I can't, even when I hear a brilliant Southerner speak, it's just, I have to work to get through the, even though I love the accent, right? It's basically, it's kind of like white, it's like intra-white racism. Mm. I mean, because I think that a lot of white Northerners think of white Southerners as the way that white racists think of blacks. You know, you're nice, interesting people who make a lot of good entertainment for us, but we would never want you to be president,
right,
or head of our company.
Or make any decisions.
Or make any important decisions, right? So anyway, you've escaped that by not having the accent, apparently, right?
I give people plenty of other reasons to not take me seriously.
Like what? What do you mean?
Oh, just being me.
Oh, yeah. But also, there was something, wasn't there something classically Southern about your family, and that it was quite a religious family, is that right?
Oh, very much so, yeah. And both of my parents converted as adults.
Oh, my.
Which is nothing worse than a convert.
Oh, Jesus, so to speak.
So they're true believers.
That I've never come across, someone whose parents converted as adults.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
Yeah.
Please talk about that.
Well, my mom was raised Catholic, but it didn't really stick for her. And then I believe it was in college, she met some, I want to say Methodists or some kind of Protestant Christian, kind of lower church. And she just really was like, they have something I don't have.
Where was she from?
She grew up, so they both grew up all over. Their parents were, their dads were Air Force fighter pilots in Vietnam.
Hmm.
And so, like, my dad was born in Japan and kind of grew up all over, lived in Iceland for a bit, but did high school in Niceville, Florida. Hmm. And my mom, same, kind of grew up, spent some formative years in Kansas, and then, I'm sorry, went to high school in Ohio. So she was in college in Ohio and met these people and wanted to know what they had, and what they had was Jesus. And she converted.
From Catholicism to?
Kind of nothing, you know, with a Catholic upbringing to evangelical Christianity.
Was there a particular denomination?
She really liked the Southern Baptist Church, which she found in New York, I want to say, when she and my dad lived in New York.
Oh, they joined the Southern Baptist Church. Wow.
Yes.
They converted to that.
I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church.
Wowza.
Yeah.
Okay. So I actually don't know a lot about that.
It's an interesting...
I mean, I know sort of from the outside, right? But I haven't studied it, I'd say. You know, but I sort of know sort of the headlines and the stereotypes. I mean, what... So do you grew up in that church? You were born in that church, basically, right?
Yes.
Okay, so they had already converted when you were born.
Yes.
Okay, so your entire childhood was in that church.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I would love to know about that. I really don't know. What is it like?
I can only speak from my experience, right? I went to probably 5 Southern Baptist churches growing up. So I know what those 5 Southern Baptist churches were like in Huntsville, Alabama, and in Birmingham a little bit. But it was really interesting how it was kind of, I would say the good is that they were very focused on evangelicism. So, you know, going into communities, solving people's problems and saying, hey, you know, while we're here fixing your roof, do you know about Jesus? Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed mission trips a lot. And I always had the choice between talking to people or doing manual labor. And I always chose manual labor. So I built a sanctuary for a Ukrainian church in Philadelphia. I fixed the roof of a low-income couple in Wyoming. I shoveled like shit and their worldly possessions in Mississippi after Katrina. That was all amazing, and I loved that. On the negative side, it was very much about what you don't do. Like, you don't have sex before marriage. Like, you don't drink. In some Southern Baptist churches, you don't dance.
Yeah.
And there's this like weird self-righteousness where it's like, I'm doing the Lord's work by not being worldly, by not sinning. So I lost my virginity at 22 on my wedding night. Like, I was a true believer myself. And then obviously I've come to reconsider a lot of those lifestyle prohibitions.
You're the she-devil now, Kathy. Yeah. Come on. I mean, you got married at 22.
I did.
Good God Almighty. But that was the right thing to do, though, wasn't it?
Well, I couldn't bring shame on my family by living in sin.
Mm-hmm. And who was this young man?
His name is Zach.
And I know, but like, what did he do besides drive NASCAR? Just kidding. Like, what?
He was a guitar, part-time guitar teacher and German tutor.
Huh. Okay. And you met him in college?
We met in college.
And you went to a Baptist school?
Samford University.
Yeah, that's Baptist.
Yep.
Southern Baptist.
So they used to be Southern Baptist, but they lost the Southern and just became Baptist.
Okay. Okay.
I think because they allowed dancing on campus.
Really? How did your parents feel about dancing?
I was a weird kid. I was not very socially adept.
Oh, really?
No, not at all.
And you became a libertarian. I can't put those two things together.
So crazy. So my parents would like try to force me to go to dances. They'd be like, go.
What percentage of libertarians do you think can dance well? What do you think?
Oh, man.
The only question is it low or high single digits for me?
I'm going to go with, I would say 10%.
10?
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
I'm going to go 10.
I'll take that bet. describe, I want to hear what your house looked like.
My house.
Yeah. Like, what did it look like?
It was small, 2 bedrooms, burglar bars on the windows.
Yeah. Why? Was it a high crime area?
I wouldn't have thought so, but we came home one day after church, actually, and our door was ajar, and someone had stolen our television and jewelry and pissed on our wall.
Pissed on your wall?
They pissed on our wall.
What did you do to them?
I don't know. But they had the misfortune of then going to rob, I want to say, like, the mayor's house or something, like...
Or the chief of police's house.
Yeah, like, something, like, real dumb. So we got all our stuff back.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And did you ever find out why this person pissed on your wall?
We did not.
Is it because they could sense that you were the she-devil already?
It was 2 libertarians.
Was it someone from church? No, I mean, like, so my father was the son of a Mormon minister in the Midwest and born and raised in that church, which was probably equally puritanical. And I remember the first time, but he was basically estranged from them. So I didn't really meet them until I was an adult, actually. And I remember the first time I was in my grandmother's, by then, apartment. She was in a senior home at that time. She had a little apartment. And I walked in, and I couldn't believe it. It was, to me, I'd never seen anything like it, having been, you know, raised in this godforsaken hellhole of sinners. It was like a museum to Jesus. And so there were no, within the Missouri Mormon sect, which is really what it is, there's no, of course, drinking, dancing, fornication, tobacco, they can't go to movies that are not, they can't go to movies that aren't religious, that aren't like have the right message, books that are not correct, paintings, art that's not, does not include Jesus, et cetera. I mean, so that's all there is. And so there were like four books and a Bible and five pictures of Jesus.
Wow.
And separate beds.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that even more puritanical than your family?
Far, far.
Okay.
Yeah.
What were you allowed to do that was fun?
My mom is not at all what you would imagine a Southern Baptist true believer.
Oh, I want to talk to your mom.
She's amazing. No, she's a much better podcast guest than I'll ever be. She's hilarious.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So does she struggle with it? Does she struggle with the repression of it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So then, but she chose it.
Yeah.
She went way out of her way to choose it because the Catholics have way more fun.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly.
She went from like the most fun Christian denomination to the least, almost least fun.
I think the Mormons have them beat.
Yeah, no, we have you beat, but they're second to, yeah, you're second in that regard. But how does she struggle with it, or how did she struggle with it?
Well, currently she struggles with it because, you know, the church is not super into premarital sex, and she lives with her fiance.
Oh my God, wait, what happened? So she divorced dad?
Yes.
And she's been and she's now living in sin.
Now she lives in sin.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, what are we going to do about that? What's happening? Like, has she been excommunicated or what?
No. They let her go to church.
Really?
Yeah.
They just treat her the way they treat the gay hairstylist, you know, in the southern town. There's always the gay hairstylist who everybody knows is gay, but no one ever talks about it, right?
I mean, you know she has faith because she kept going to church after her divorce. You know, they're not nice to divorce women.
No.
In the church either.
No. But they've tolerated her.
Well, you know, she's a great woman.
Well, yeah, but is that it? I mean, was there a conflict or do they just not speak about it?
Yeah, it's much more passive aggressive than aggressive.
Hmm.
It's just kind of like,
how does she reconcile it intellectually, or does she?
I think that her faith is similar to mine in that it's just something that we've experienced, that it's not something that can be intellectually reconciled.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have an experience and you explain it this way or you don't.
And are you a believer still?
I am a believer.
Oh, you
still.
Are?
I am.
And that's how you would express it, how you would describe it?
That's how I describe it for me.
Okay. Yeah. So it's non-denominational. Would you even call it Christian, a Christian belief?
I call it Christian, but it's certainly non-denominational.
What's your attitude toward Jesus?
I like him.
Yeah. How so? How much? In what ways?
I don't know. I'm still figuring it out.
No, seriously. Like, how do you read the Gospels? How do you read him?
I think that Jesus, I've had experiences and continue to have experiences that feel like Jesus, I don't know, is there for me, cares about me, intercedes. And I don't have any proof of that. And in fact, I've read that there are actually differences in people's brains that make them more and less likely to attribute random.
Ew, I do not like where you're going right now, but keep going. You know, you shouldn't. This is essentialism, but keep going.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm attributing.
Wait, some people are wired to be Christians?
Some people are wired to be superstitious, yes.
Yeah, isn't this the Sam Harris character talks about this stuff? Isn't this his thing? Like, that was his PhD thesis, I think.
Really?
He could show the brain scans is complete nonsense. But yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you're nonsense. I'm saying that is nonsense to me. Brain scans could show, you could predict, you know, the likelihood of someone becoming religious, a religious thinker.
We're probably not there yet.
Yeah.
But to me, the idea that people would have predispositions toward superstition, it seems true.
Yeah, I just wouldn't say that it's wired or you're born with it, but I would say that, you know, from it's so early on, whatever, it gets in there so early on that we can't ever know whether we're born with it or it just came on when we were infants or whatever, right?
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah, so you're just saying you feel like your brain is wired in that particular way.
I feel very strongly that my brain is wired toward a superstitious.
Right, so here's the thing about Jesus, though, that I was getting at. Like when I... You know, so I was born and raised as a socialist in Berkeley, right? So which meant that I never read, and my parents were both atheists because my father utterly rejected the church and like all the way became like a complete hedonist. But so that meant that I never read the Bible. at all, not a word of it, until I went to college. But that was one of the first things I did. I took a Bible class. We read every single word of the Bible, studied it. I thought it was fascinating, number one. Number two was, I was like, damn, Jesus is my homie. He's my comrade. He's a socialist. He is. To me, that's my reading. I don't think it's the right reading. I think it's one reading. I also think he's completely ascetic. And I think that it is basically a giant assault, the Bible, the New Testament especially, a giant assault on the body and sexual pleasure. That's my reading. And I think it's mostly Paul, by the way, not so much Jesus, but Paul is just not a fan of the sex, is he? And we haven't even talked about gender roles yet, but like just in terms of sex, I don't find it to be terribly conducive to fun. However, there are major strains I know, certainly within American Christianity, not where you come from, that are highly sensual, and you could even say sexual, and have a very different reading of Jesus. In fact, in particular, I'm thinking of the Black Church, which I think is very, very sensual. And I've written about people who read Jesus as practically a hedonist, actually, you know? So why I'm asking you, Kathy, what's your reading on those questions, which are so central to your life, right?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what my background is. So yeah. I would consider myself pretty sex obsessed.
Obsessed?
Yes.
Oh, not just positive, but
yes.
Obsessed.
Yes. Well, you come to a philosophy like sex positivity because you think about it. It's not something most people are just, they're not raised sex positive, especially with that term.
Yeah, so let's do that, because I'm sure a lot of listeners know what you're talking about, but some will not. Like, what is this thing, sex positive feminism?
Oh, certainly, yes. So there are disagreements, but I think the most useful definition is sex positivity posits that sex is inherently morally neutral.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, it is not inherently good or bad. It is not inherently meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
That any meaning or moral meaning, I guess, I don't have a better word, that we put on sex, we put on sex.
Yeah, yeah. So I've been meaning to tell you something for about 5 years. I haven't told you. I learned a big lesson from you that's changed my life. It's changing my life because I'm always trying to implement it. You said many, many years ago somewhere, I don't even remember, but I heard you say this, sex is transactional. Relationships are transactional. You said romantic relations, intimate relationships are transactional, and we should think about them as transactional. And that exploded my head. And I thought you were right. And I had never thought of that before. It was a completely foreign, exotic idea I had never heard before, never considered before. I think you're right. I think it's a much, much better way, for me at least, to live and to think about my relationships that way.
Huh.
So I wanted to thank you for that. But that's also what you're describing here, right? That's your take on sex positive feminism, which I think is also, I think you have your own particular, there are other sex positive feminists. I know all five of them who have different riffs on it. That's your particular riff, which I especially like, the amorality of it. I love dearly. And I think that is the key in some ways to happiness for a lot of people, you know, to treat relationships more like that. I know it's really hard, right? I'm sure you struggle. Well, I know you do because you've written about this every single second in every relationship you have, because I'm going to stop talking. I want to ask you this. Because this has also been eating at me in a good way when I've been thinking about you. You talk about love, and you also talk about relationships being transactional. That seems to me to be a contradiction, or maybe not. I need you to resolve that for me, because you've talked recently, in fact, about love, being in love, loving someone, them loving you, and not so much. But that's a category that you employ or have employed. And I thought, why is Kathy Reisenwitz of all people talking about love when she's the one who taught me to treat relationships as transactional?
Well, I want to talk about what I am saying when I say that relationships are transactional. I would say that it would be easy to view it as you do something quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. And it is, to an extent. Healthy relationships, I think, are there's a healthy give and take. And what you give and what you take isn't always or even usually the same thing. But I believe that ideally relationships are not one way. right? And I think we all kind of intuit that. But the more I think we think about it, I think, you know, the better off we are, especially if what we're doing isn't working for us. And that's been the story of my life. The reason that I've thought about all of these things is because what I was doing was not working for me. And so I'm very jealous of people who don't need to think about these things because their instincts are good. Hmm. Mine have not been.
Hmm.
I would say that one thing that I've struggled with is the extent to which you extend your time horizon for that give and take, right? In every relationship, there will be times when you're giving and times when you're taking, if it's a healthy one. And
right. What
are you willing to give and for how long and what do you expect in return are things that, again, some people just kind of intuit and they mm-hmm. figure it out and it works for them.
Right.
Other people, like me, you know, that's been a real problem for me. You know, when I was in my marriage, I had expectations of what my husband would do for me and for our family. And I gave, I felt like, and I didn't feel like my expectations were being met. And so I had to think about, okay, what is a reasonable expectation? And so I think love is a lot of things, but it's a lot of that. It's a lot of what do you expect? What are you willing to do to get it? And are you with someone who finds that to be a reasonable and an expectation they can meet?
Okay. So that sounds transactional. That sounds like a transactional love.
Yeah.
Which is great. I'm glad you're consistent. That's good. You know, because most Americans think of love as transcendental, right? It's above. It's this special mystical thing that's above, you know, give and take and above, you know, how many times you take out the garbage versus how many times you suck my dick or whatever, whatever it is, right? Right? It's this thing that's like you can't even just, it's ineffable. You can't describe it. You can't see it. It's just this thing that's beautiful and we must have it.
Right.
And you're not. I love, it's almost like, and this makes sense being a libertarian, like you have like an economist's approach, right, to love.
Well, I think that it's, I'll say in my defense, when you look at the research on love, right, what causes people to feel warm fuzzies and those things that we think of as love, taking out the fucking garbage. Like,
yeah. When
you do things for people, they feel good.
Uh-huh. And then you get a blowjob.
No. Yeah. Or not, you know, whatever. Right.
Depends on how well you take out the garbage
yeah.
and how often.
Whatever the fuzzies are for you.
It's the service you're doing for the other person, essentially.
It's the five love languages, right?
It's what?
The five love languages.
What's that?
Physical touch, quality time, words of affirmation, gifts. I don't know. I always forget
where is that from? I've never heard that before.
It's like a book. I think it's evangelical, actually.
Yeah,
I think it's like a
Christian book. That's why I haven't heard of it. Okay. Yeah, but Christians aren't always wrong, even to me. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Those are the five. Those sounds like things that I value, right? Value is subjective, but
absolutely.
Just turns out that a lot of us value those particular things.
Right.
So if you give us those things, we're probably going to love you.
Yeah, and I've always felt like this whole like, I fell out of love and I don't know what happened. Like, well, think about it. You know, there's probably something that happened. There's probably something you can do.
Okay. Back to Jesus. So I didn't let you cause I interrupted you. What's your reading? How do you read Jesus on those questions of sex, sensuality, pleasure, the body?
So this started in college where I went to church with my best friend. Her name was Catherine. I've had two best friends named Catherine. I don't know what that means. And she and I heard the person leading the class say, you know, and it was a discussion. And most of the people in the class agreed that it's not appropriate for women to lead Bible study over men. That women should teach women and men should teach men and women, but women should not teach men. And I said, well, okay, so you don't want your son to have a female teacher at school? And they're like, no, that's fine. It's just biblical things that we don't want them.
Hmm.
And I'm like, okay, where's this from? Because I had never heard this. I mean, women are not allowed to be pastors in the Southern Baptist Church, I believe. They certainly weren't when I was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understood a certain amount of like, man is the head of the family.
But apparently a lot of gays are.
gays are what?
Allowed to be pastors in the Southern Baptist Church, because we're constantly hearing about Baptist pastors who are really gay.
But oh, yes, that's okay. That's true.
But yeah, okay, so what was their rationale? What was their, did they have one? Why can't women teach the scripture?
So Paul, in one of his letters, said, I do not permit a woman to be over a man.
Yep.
And so that, I was just like, no, that doesn't seem right. This is dumb. You know, this is dumb. And so I started to read other people's perspectives on this prohibition. And what they kind of explained is that there are parts of the New Testament where Paul is very clearly speaking to a specific, sometimes even person, at a specific time about a specific issue. You know, pay this person back. They, you know, you owe them money, for example. To me, it seemed very clear that a lot of the prohibitions that Paul gives to the churches in early Christianity were aimed at, okay, we're already doing this crazy shit by worshiping this guy named Jesus. We're not going to lead a cultural revolution at the same time, right? So, you know, keep wearing, you know, keep your heads covered, keep, you know, not being openly gay, keep women in their place, mm-hmm. not because this is some everlasting moral obligation, but because it's inconvenient to our what we're trying to accomplish.
Right. It wasn't strategic.
It was not strategic.
Oh, that's really. So you think that eventually, or that deep down inside, they were libertarian in this way, the early Christians?
I think they were
culturally libertarian.
Not, I think if they were culturally libertarian, at least the libertarianism I subscribe to, they would have a position that, okay, these are bad social customs that we should not follow. They didn't care. Like,
yeah.
The cultural customs were not important to them. They thought they were going to get raptured, like, in a few months to years.
Right, right.
So the idea that Paul knew he was setting down cultural prohibitions that would last 2,000, it's not true. Like, he didn't think that. And I don't think he was. So yeah. I think they were like, how do we get through the next, you know, few months to few years? And how you do that is you don't make people who are already suspicious of what you're doing even get their hackles up even more by being unconventional in ways that you don't need to be.
And this is your reading even of Paul?
That is my reading of Paul.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Have you read St. Augustine, City of God?
Yes.
Yeah. So you cannot possibly make that argument about him.
No.
Okay, good.
Not at all.
Because so in other words, there's the early Christians and then there's the, whatever you call them, the next wave of Christian intellectuals, essentially. And Augustine is probably the most important. And boy, is that a book everyone should read, right? I mean, that is a, I called Paul's epistle to the Romans an assault on the body, but my goodness, City of God is a nuclear war, right? Against sex and the body. I mean, he really makes it plain. I love that book because of that. It makes it so clear sort of what the roots, the deep roots of this particular culture are, mm-hmm. right? I think are right there in that repression.
Yeah.
Is that your reading too? Of sort of subsequent interpretations of Christianity?
So I went to an abstinence retreat.
Oh my gosh.
In high school.
Okay. Of course, right? That's what everyone did, didn't they? I mean, isn't that standard in the Southern Baptist Church for like a particular class of people?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, certainly it was unambiguous what the right thing to do was. And I know purity balls are,
super fun.
I never actually went, but popular.
Yeah, yeah.
And purity rings.
So you went to abstinence, what was it, summer camp?
Retreat, just a weekend, just a weekend.
Oh, just a weekend.
Just a weekend.
And were you sex obsessed then?
Well, see, and I'm like, did I like the Southern Baptist Church because I was sex obsessed, or did I become sex obsessed because of the Southern Baptist Church?
Yeah.
I don't know, and I'll never know, but.
Well, because you know what they say about repression. You know, it can be pretty sexy.
Yeah.
Right?
Certainly.
I mean, do you think that is what's going on here?
Likely.
Well, you don't know is what you just said.
To an extent.
Cause and effect, you're not sure about.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I don't know.
But so, I was obsessed. They had a thing to say about it, you know?
Oh, you were obsessed then?
I was obsessed then.
Okay.
And I thought,
I really want to have good sex, mm-hmm. right? And it doesn't seem like my friends are really having great sex, and it doesn't seem like a lot of adults are. And there was no answer to that, except what I could find in the Southern Baptist Church was, if you stayed a virgin and then got married to another virgin, that's the right way to do it, and God will bless you with a great marriage and great sex life. And I was like, I don't know if it's true, but it's better than anybody else is offering. So I'm going to do it because I want this.
So when you say you're sex obsessed, do you just mean that you want to have sex a lot? Or is it that you think about sexuality a lot? Or what is it? Because that can mean a lot of things, right?
All of it.
All of it?
Yeah.
Okay. So you see the world like through a lens of sexuality?
Uh-huh.
Right. So like that's kind of what like queer theorists do. It's what I do a lot of times, right? You sort of analyze. I mean, I know you do this. You analyze the world through that lens, mm-hmm. right? You see sexuality where other people don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, which is, well, that's what Freud and Foucault did, right? And so that's what I do often. I used to do it a lot. I used to be obsessed in that way. Uh-huh. Once I learned about that stuff, and gender too, right? Mm-hmm. Gender and sexuality, you put those lenses on, the world looks different. Now, a lot of people listening are like, Thad, stop talking. You're one of those SJWs. And what I'm going to say back to you motherfuckers is you need to read those texts and do it yourself, and you're going to see things you've never seen before that are going to change your life. And you may not become Kathy Reisenwitz, but I guarantee you might be freer.
So, don't be afraid.
Because they just don't know. They haven't read this stuff.
Right.
And I do think, I agree that a whole bunch, a mountain of stuff coming out of gender studies is idiotic and totalitarian and horrific and gobbledygook and all the rest of it. But the core insights from the original thinkers who have influenced you and me, I guarantee you every libertarian should embrace.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or at least be informed.
Yeah, at least read the damn thing before Absolutely. You dismiss it as postmodernist SJW, whatever the latest epithet is.
If you only read feminist ideas as presented by people who consider themselves intellectual opponents, you don't understand.
Of course.
But people don't get that. They think that the ideas are being presented fairly and accurately by ideological opponents. And yes, sometimes an ideological opponent can present an idea completely accurately and fairly. Not usually. Mm-hmm. That's very rare.
Do you remember, this was when you were making a splash in libertarian circles. Do you remember when Salon ran a hit piece on libertarianism about every single day?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And all the libertarians were like, oh my God, these people are so unfair and they've never read Mises or Hayek and they are so mean to us. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. Well, you should think about this because that's exactly what you do to all these people who have something to teach you.
Absolutely.
Believe me, I hate probably most people who identify as feminists now. I do. I mean, like, hate them. I think they're horrible. I was railing to you before we turned on the mics about a particular famous feminist I won't name. But I mean, I just think there are so many public famous feminists now who I just think are utterly dishonest, mean, and totalitarian. And I'm not exaggerating. But I'm also mostly pissed off at them because the many original feminist texts, especially from the late 60s and early 70s when sex positive feminism first became a thing, and then back in the 20s when it was also sort of, there was a proto sex positive feminism too, are as important to me in my thinking and my life as any thinker there's ever been. And I think you're not going to, the way I define liberation and freedom is not going to happen unless I go through those ideas. So they're extremely important. Now, the problem is that's the wheat. And there's just a mountain of chaff around it that calls itself feminism, which is grotesque, and it's not feminism. To me, the way I define it, and I think maybe the way you define it. But so how did you, I'm assuming your family was Southern Baptist on these issues as well, right?
Certainly.
Your mom was a housewife?
She was, but my parents got divorced when I was like 8.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so they were they started fucking up right away, pretty much. They couldn't hold on. I mean, the converts, is this what happened? They sort of converted and found out how hard it is to be that repressed all the time? And how monogamy is kind of the hardest thing to make work? Am I just reading too much into this?
I would say that what happened to them is similar to what happened to me, except I kind of more walked away from the church than they have. Certainly, they still go to church. But they were just really, really ill-suited and really unhappy.
Mm-hmm. So
for each other.
For each other, yeah.
Oh, back to abstinence camp or the workshop this was. So what do they teach you?
Why and how?
Why what?
Why abstinence?
Oh, and how?
And how?
Well, you don't put the penis in. I mean, how much more did they have to say?
You know, avoid temptation.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
And what did they recommend or suggest? How does one avoid temptation? especially these days, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess just don't be alone with your
computer.
Somebody you would want. Well, it was really hard to get the porn back. I'm 33, so it was a dial-up.
Okay. Oh, dial-up porn. God damn, that was horrible. Yeah. Waiting for, 5 minutes for one image to appear on your screen. So don't be alone with another person of the opposite sex, because they weren't even worried about gays yet, were they?
No, we barely. Did we talk about it? I'm not sure.
That's right. That's like the next phase. That's the next level baptism. But, okay, what else did they tell you? Like, what? Did they talk about porn at all?
No, not really.
They talk about masturbation? What's their position on masturbation?
I don't remember. I do remember there was one of those exercises where they gave us, I want to say it was a piece of tape, and then we, put the tape on other people to show what happens, that it loses its stickiness the more you use it.
Ooh.
So the theory is if you have sex with a lot of people, the attachment and bonding that is supposed to happen in a marriage,
Ooh, that's good.
You come in damaged.
Ooh, that's good.
Yeah.
They're good.
Oh, yeah.
They've been doing this for a while.
I found it compelling.
Yeah, that's well done, Baptists. Mm. Damn. Mm. No wonder. Now so much makes sense for me in my life. Okay, so
same girl.
Okay, so all right, have I painted the whole picture?
Oh, you asked about masturbation.
Oh yeah.
So we didn't talk.
I always ask about masturbation.
So much about it at abstinence retreat, but so I have a stepsister, two stepsisters. One is only 8 months younger than me. My parents, my dad, and my stepmother took us on a different retreat, just the four of us, to Chattanooga, Tennessee. We got a hotel. And it was a puberty weekend where we talked about, it was a weekend of talk.
I'm sorry, was that the name of the weekend?
I don't know what they called it.
Puberty weekend 94 featuring Pastor Jim.
So we listened to tapes of this book. It was designed for this purpose. And I want to say it was James Dobson.
Oh.
I want to say.
Oh, Family Research Council.
Yeah.
Nice. So Dobson specializes in puberty.
You produced a tool, course.
The special issues raised by puberty. Uh-huh. And what did you learn about your precious little body?
That masturbation, I think, was okay as long as you weren't fantasizing about sex. Because, if you think about sinning, you have sinned. So if you lust after a woman, it's like you've had sex with her already.
Okay. That's a pretty high bar. Okay.
And it was definitely geared toward boys. The whole masturbation discussion was
Oh, really? They weren't worried about you too much?
No.
Because they didn't know.
Right.
Really? Because they used to crack down on women masturbating back in the day. They stopped doing that?
It was not spoken of.
Really?
No, it was assumed that we didn't do it.
Your church, for whatever reason, was only worried about the boys.
Yeah.
That's so sexist, first of all. Why did we get all that?
Yeah, sorry.
You should feel bad for us. So, wait, hold on. Did he say that it was okay if you weren't thinking about sex with a woman while you were masturbating? Is that what was said by James Dobson of the Family Research Council?
My memory is terrible, and I could definitely be making this up out of whole cloth, and I could definitely be misinterpreting it. But it'd be a weird thing to make up.
Let's just think. Is it intellectually consistent, though?
It is intellectually consistent.
Okay, that's important. That's what's important,
it's
right?
It's not super feasible, but it's intellectually consistent.
I mean, within the church. Is it intellectually consistent within the church's
Absolutely.
Teachings? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So how would one do that? You masturbate without thinking about sex. What are you supposed to think about?
Power?
Rainbows and unicorns, little girls. What? Power? Is that what you said? Yes, that's what they're, of course. Think about conquest.
I don't know.
Think, Think about conquering a continent full of brown people and converting them while you're masturbating. Right? Think about building a giant cathedral with a cross on top of it while you're masturbating.
We don't
just don't think about Jesus while you're masturbating.
We don't kink shame here.
God, what I would give to attend the puberty weekend. How can I do that? How do I do that? I want to get press credentials or something.
If you find those tapes.
Puberty weekend.
I bet it exists.
Wow. Oh, God, that's funny. Okay. All right. So, sex-obsessed Southern Baptist girl in Huntsville, Alabama. What the fuck? You know, okay. And here you are in San Francisco talking about all kinds of bad things. So, I want to say one last thing to you that is maybe unrelated. I don't know. I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but you've been reminding me of a very famous historical fictional character while we've been talking. And it's purely because of the way you look, and it's because of one particular thing on your body. I'm going to slightly objectify you here. Rosie the Riveter? Well, hang on. Just hang on. You're going to like where this ends up, I think. So you know the Rosie the Riveter poster, right? What she's doing?
Yeah.
She's flexing her arm, her bicep.
Uh-huh.
And she's wearing a blue work shirt with a collar. You're wearing, your shirt is a blue shirt with a collar. It's checked, and unlike hers, but it's the same color blue.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have on your bicep my favorite tattoo that I've ever seen on anybody.
That is quite a compliment.
Right? So your tattoo says,
I own me.
I own me. I love that.
Thank you.
I've always loved that. I've seen pictures of it. And I just thought, man, because I don't like tattoos.
Mm.
Your generation, for the most part, your generation makes very bad choices when it comes to tattoos, but I do absolutely adore that one.
Thank you.
And I adore what you're doing here. And I've learned a lot from you.
I really appreciate that.
Over many years. And thank you for doing this, Kathy.
Same. Thank you for having me. Thank you for gave me some book recommendations a few years ago. I really appreciate that.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Ellen Willis.
Right. Mm-hmm. Ellen Willis, the greatest. Mm-hmm. Yes. The greatest sex positive feminist of all time.
Yes, certainly.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Everyone should read Ellen Willis and Kathy Reisman. Oh, so give a plug.
Absolutely.
You have several plugs to give.
Yes. Thank you so much. So I've actually started a new podcast with my job. It's called Does It Work? By Biomarker Labs. And it is a skeptical, fact-based, we hope, take on the wellness industry.
Hmm.
So we talk about whether things work.
Yeah.
Looking for guests as well. So if you have something to say about health and wellness, we'd love to have you on. I also am writing for the Bay City Beacon. So I have a housing column there called Unintended Consequences. Check us out at thebaycitybeacon.com. And active on Facebook and Twitter as usual. And most of my writing ends up on Sex and the State, which is at KathyReisenwitz.com. Twitter is at Kathy Reisenwitz. Facebook, Facebook.com/KathyReisenwitz. Instagram, I'm on there. I'm out there.
We will put all of this on the show notes. So Wonderful. Everyone should go there and click as hard as they can on all of this. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Cool. Good?
That was great.
Good. This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredunderground.com. To get information and to buy tickets to the Renegade University weekend events in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. Thanks for listening.